Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome everyone to this Straight Up. Today we are going to be discussing an article that came out on Friday, September 6, 2019. The title of this one, It's the Pace of Change That Kills You. Subtitle is, And Now It's Sped Up Beyond Our Means to Control It. A treasured member of my family is in the process of dying right now, and she's lived a rich, full life, but her passing is a sad affair for all of us. And I spent a lot of time recently with hospice workers, and I've learned that they're often asked by their patients, how much time do I have left? The family members want to know. It's a very common question. And while sometimes loath to offer an answer, hospice staff can predict the timing of the end pretty accurately. And they do so by measuring the changes they see, or more accurately, the pace of change in those changes. Could a patient pick a book up off the floor in June but not July? If not, then the remaining time is likely to be measured in months. Could they raise themselves out of a chair last week but not this week? If not, then it may be only weeks until the end. Are they losing their functions every day? Then death is likely just days away. And so on, right through hours and minutes and seconds. It's the pace of change that matters. Tracking the pace of change is as important as the actual changes themselves. Both provide critical information about what's going on, but it's the pace that informs our timing predictions. This is equally true for larger complex systems like economies and ecosystems. The pace is accelerating all around us. Losing a certain population of a given species over a million years is a very different proposition from losing the same number within just 40 years, or even yearly, as now seems to be the case. The years 2016, 17, 18, and 2019 each saw one or more Cat 5 hurricanes form in the Atlantic. This is the longest such stretch of years in the record books. Dorian, the recent hurricane, was absolutely brutal to the Bahamas. The damage was unprecedented and extreme. I can't even imagine the sustained horror of being pinned down by a Cat 5 for 36 hours as it brutally dismantled my home. Like slow-moving Hurricane Harvey, not a Cat 5, but hugely damaging, Dorian just parked itself over the Bahamas and laid waste to all that lay beneath, churning, just like a massive blender. Are monster storms that move slowly a new meteorological trend, or has it simply been bad luck to experience so many of late? We don't know yet, but there have only been 35 Cat 5 hurricanes in the past 100 years. However, at our current pace, there will be 125 such storms over the next century. That's four times as many versus the past. Negative rates are multiplying at a staggering rate. Financially, the latest and most head-spinning change concerns the explosive proliferation of debts with negative interest rates. Unheard of since the Mesopotamian invention of debt back in 2400 BC, negative interest rates have suddenly appeared on the financial landscape like a new mutant species, an invader without natural predators, gaining a sudden foothold and then spreading rapidly. It's as if a virulent chestnut blight landed in a virgin forest of corporate and sovereign debt. From literally none 10 years ago to more than $17 trillion, with a T, now. And it's up from a mere $6 trillion in just the past 10 months alone. That's the pace of change that concerns me here. Is this a new permanent trend? We don't know yet. We're going to have to wait and see. But the pace of change is sure intensifying. I have a chart below here where I look at where interest rates suddenly went below zero. This is looking at Japan, the euro area, Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland. And what we see in this chart is that first Switzerland gave negative rates a tentative go. And that was back in 2012. And then Denmark timidly followed, went below and back up towards zero. But eventually the entire euro era complex followed with gusto. Many countries' rates crossing below the 0% bound in late 2014. And since then, it's just accelerated. Whatever the final repercussions are, one fact is clear. The world's central banks are completely 100% responsible for these bizarro world negative interest rates. They try to pretend that the $20+ trillion of money printing spree that they engineered after 2008 isn't a root cause. Instead, they claim the markets are responsible. But this is as weak a defense as Ted Bundy claiming his victims all killed themselves. It's just not a credible defense. Emboldened by seeing that nothing terribly bad happened in the early years of negative rates, the ECB went on an absolute tear of a printing spree in 2016 and 17. It went so far as to buy corporate debt by a private placement, meaning the debt was never issued to the bond market even. The ECB just conjured up the necessary billions of euros and directly credited corporate accounts while taking their bonds onto its books. Again, it's just worth noting how unusual this all is. It's never been done before. 5,000 years of accumulated knowledge is being chucked out the window by activist central bankers who assume they know best. But do they? And what will be the repercussions if they don't? Economic and social vandalism. That's what we're going to discuss now. The financial media is working very, very hard to diffuse concerns about negative rates and sell them as a talisman against anything that could hurt the economy. They dutifully scribe down what the central bankers say and then pitch it to us as gospel. Instead, I propose that now is the time to ask some really stiff questions of the central bankers and to not let them avoid answering. Keep asking until we either receive reasonable responses or clarify that they actually have no good answers to give. Here are the questions I would love to hear posed to Chairman Powell, Draghi, or Kuroda. Question 1. Your actions were designed to spike the prices of stocks and bonds, and you've succeeded. This has led to an enormous wealth gap. What's too far in your view? Right now, 5 people have as much wealth as the bottom half of all humanity, by which we mean 3.8 billion humans. So, is too far when those same 5 individuals own as much as the bottom 75% of humanity? The bottom 90%? Or is it your aim that these top 5 individuals should actually possess everything in the world with everyone in their debt? Wouldn't you love to hear the answer to that question? Here's the next one. Sirs, 5,000 years of financial trial and error has firmly established that saved capital deserves a positive rate of return. You are now certain that negative interest rates are what the world needs. What empirical data do you rely on to make that assessment? And what happens if you're wrong? Love to hear the answer to that one, too. Next question. Sirs, all investment decisions depend upon an assumed rate of return. Pensions, for example, require matching future liabilities with current assets and an assumed rate of return on those assets. Now that central banks are certain that negative yielding debt is just what the doctor ordered, and under the principle of you break it, you buy it, we're wondering what responsibilities the central banks are prepared to assume here for broken pensions. I'd love to hear the answer to that one, of course. And a follow-on question to that would be same question as above, but for savers and endowments, because all of those crews are going to be actually destroyed by negative rates. Next question. Money is not actual wealth, but a claim on real wealth. More importantly, it's a social contract. Central bankers are monkeying with that social contract, and the effects are obvious. Corporations are incentivized to make returns by financially engineering their balance sheets and rigging their share counts instead of taking actual risks like hiring more people and investing in R&D. Can we not just take this all the way to the end and propose eliminating risk for everyone and just give everyone money without anyone performing any work at all? Obviously not, but we're also obviously somewhere along that path. The question is, how far is too far? And what criteria are you using to determine that? See, I think that the central banks really need to talk, be asked and held accountable for all of the things that they're doing, which have really clear and obvious effects. It's not like they tried something last week and we're being sort of skeptical about it. We're 10 years into this. We've already seen what's happened, right? There's a quick aside here. Draghi just came out in his ECB statement and said, well, you know, our policies have had some side effects and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, side effects? You mean ruined savers, ruined pensions, ruined banking structures in the EU are side effects? That's all they can conceive of. It's like, oh, we got some side effects. No, it's been really obvious that these side effects are profound in their social, financial, and political dimensions. And nobody asks any questions. It's like, oh, you know, we just make money. We're not responsible for the rest of that stuff. Yes, you are, because money is a social contract, which means it's political, too. All right, next question. Endless growth, sirs, is not possible on a finite planet. Your policies are all geared towards stoking the fastest economic growth possible. Do central banks have any responsibility to future generations in leaving behind a world worth inheriting? Your answers, sir. All right. So those are the sorts of questions that I would love to have asked, and we deserve to know the answers to them and to a dozen other such questions. Why nobody in the press or Congress is asking any of them is a different story for another day. While it's possible that the central bankers are competent, benevolent experts doing their best, it's equally possible that they are the largest economic and social and political vandals in all of history. Given that possibility, the Overton window, which we have a link to if you don't know what that means, really needs to be smashed wider, really and quickly, so that we can get answers to these impolite but necessary questions. If it turns out that the central bankers have thoughtful, intelligent responses to them, then fine. We can debate the assumptions in the data. If, on the other hand, they get snippy and affronted by being challenged, it'll mean they have no good answers. It will unveil they're merely winging it when literally everything is on the line. It will mean, for the sake of ease and expediency, they're basically dismantling a cultural heritage site as a scavenge for handy building materials, turning architectural splendors into crude stone huts. In other words, they'd be unmasked as economic and social vandals, wrecking the infrastructure of financial knowledge and thousands of years of cultural arrangements simply because they're too intellectually lazy or too emotionally weak to do otherwise. We have to be our own rescuers. The powers that be, like central bankers, politicians, they're just humans. They err. They have to operate with imperfect information. Look, I get that. But they are also mostly untrained in systems thinking, resource limits, other really essential fields, which they could correct if they cared or they dared. The central banks could hire people who have systems thinking, give them prominent roles. They could hire somebody who understands resource limits. They don't. But they aren't, you know, they aren't doing any of these things. And because of that, the pace and the scope of the changes happening are beyond their powers of comprehension, let alone their powers to fix. While the central bankers are busy over there in the first E in the economy, you know, printing money and doing stuff, things are happening in all these fields around them, distorting effects in social areas, in political arenas, in the ecological areas. So many things are changing right now, and the rate of change, that's speeding up too. It's barely possible to fashion a comprehensive plan for what to do about it. It's probably too much to expect that anyone in power would have the necessary broad-based systems thinking required to concoct a reasonable plan forward. Someday, we'll begin to run out of fossil fuels, and we don't have any plan for that. We haven't a clue what to do about the rapidly intensifying weather. Nobody knows how we're going to grow enough food for 9 billion people when the phosphate runs out. But instead of planning for these certain challenges, what are our leaders doing instead? The central bankers are continuing to ease financial conditions and to lower interest rates. Politicians squabble about marginal, ultimately unimportant distractions. And universities enforce spaces safe from microaggressions so that nobody's ever offended, leaving these people woefully unprepared for the future that's coming. Everybody is still doing the very same things that have moved us away from what has served us well for 5,000 years: positive interest rates and a stable climate. The rate of change is accelerating. Things are speeding up. That's how exponential systems behave. It's not surprising to those who understand it, but it's shocking to behold anyway. It's dead simple at this point to conclude that we're on course for a massive financial accident and a major ecological upheaval that will make it difficult, if not impossible, to feed everyone too. If we don't change direction dramatically and soon, these eventualities are about as close to guaranteed outcomes as you can get. It's not a future prediction, that's a trend extrapolation. Will society make the necessary changes in time? I kind of doubt it. Don't you? Our signposts along the way for the timing and arrival of the next crisis will come from closely tracking the pace of change in developments from here. And for me, recent events have accelerated to the point that I'm no longer comfortable residing in my current house. In part two, titled Alert, Time to Relocate, I explain the factors compelling me to leave my community of 15 plus years for a safer, more resilient, and liberty-respecting location, and I share the qualities I prioritize highest when evaluating the new property to relocate to. And of course, it's not about the property, it's about the community of people that are going to join there. Those who followed me for years know I very rarely issue alerts, and maybe four or five so far. And I only do so, that's over 10 years, and I only do so when I arrive at important conclusions that cause me to take a major action in my own life. So if I see something that makes me do something, I'll tell you about it. The pace of change in world developments is now high enough for me to undertake a big life change like this. How about you?